It has its risks. It's not what you would call honourable, I grant you, but it will get you to your queen quicker than the demon road. Tell me, said Quentin Martell.
Dunk woke upon his back, staring up at the arches of a barrel-vaulted ceiling. For a moment, he did not know where he was or how he had arrived there. Voices echoed in his head and faces drifted past him. Old Ser Arlen, Tansel Tutal, Bennis of the Brown Shield, the Red Widow, Baylor Breakspear, Arion the Bright Prince, Mad, Sad Lady Vaith. Then all at once the joust came back to him. The heat, the snail, the iron fist coming at his face. He groaned and rolled onto one elbow. The movement set his skull to pounding like some monstrous war drum. Both his eyes seemed to be working, at least, nor could he feel a hole in his head, which was all to the good. He was in some cellar, he saw, with casks of wine and ale on every side. At least it is cool here, he thought, and drink is close at hand. The taste of blood was in his mouth. Dunk felt a stab of fear. If he had bitten off his tongue, he would be dumb as well as thick. Good morrow, he croaked just to hear his voice. The words echoed off the ceiling. Dunk tried to push himself onto his feet, but the effort set the cellar spinning. Slowly, slowly, said a quavery voice close at hand. A stooped old man appeared beside the bed, clad in robes as gray as his long hair. About his neck was a maester's chain of many metals. His face was aged and lined with deep creases on either side of a great beak of a nose. Be still and let me see your eyes. He peered in Dunk's left eye and then the right, holding them open between his thumb and forefinger. My head hurts. The maester snorted. Be grateful it still rests upon your shoulders, sir. Here, this may help somewhat. Drink. Dunk made himself swallow every drop of the foul potion and managed not to spit it out. The tourney, he said, wiping his mouth with the back of his hand. Tell me, what's happened? The same foolishness that always happens in these affrays. Men have been knocking each other off horses with sticks. Lord Smallwood's nephew broke his wrist, and Sir Eden Risley's leg was crushed beneath his horse. But no one has been killed thus far, though I had my fears for you, sir. Was I unhorsed? His head still felt as though it were stuffed full of wool, else he would never have asked such a stupid question. Dunk regretted it the instant the words were out. With a crash that shook the highest ramparts, those who had wagered good coin on you were most distraught, and your squire was beside himself. He would be sitting with you still if I had not chased him off. I need no children underfoot. I reminded him of his duty. Dunk found that he needed reminding himself. What duty? Your mount, sir. Your arms and armor. Yes, Dunk said, remembering. The boy was a good squire. He knew what was required of him. I have lost the old man's sword and the armor that Steely Pate forged for me. Your fiddling friend was also asking after you. He told me you were to have the best of care. I threw him out as well. How long have you been tending me? Dunk flexed the fingers of his sword hand. All of them still seemed to work. Only my head's hurt, and Sir Arlen used to say I never used that anyway.
4 hours by the sundial.
4 hours was not so bad. He had once heard tale of a knight struck so hard that he slept for 40 years and woke to find himself old and withered. Do you know if Sir Uthor won his second tilt? Maybe the snail would win the tourney. It would take some sting from the defeat if Dunk could tell himself that he had lost to the best knight in the field.
That one? Indeed he did. Against Sir Adam Frey, cousin to the bride and a promising young lance. Her ladyship fainted when Sir Adam fell. She had to be helped back to her chambers.
Dunk forced himself to his feet, reeling as he rose, but the maester helped to steady him.
Where are my clothes? I must go. I must.
If you cannot recall, it cannot be so very urgent.
The maester made an irritated motion.
I would suggest that you avoid rich foods, strong drink, and further blows between your eyes. But I learned long ago that knights are deaf to sense. Go, go! I have other fools to tend.
Outside, Dunk glimpsed a hawk soaring in wide circles through the bright blue sky. He envied him. A few clouds were gathering to the east, dark as Dunk's mood. As he found his way back to the tilting ground, the sun beat down on his head like a hammer on an anvil. The earth seemed to move beneath his feet, or it might just be that he was swaying. He had almost fallen twice climbing the cellar steps. I should have heeded Egg. He made his slow way across the outer ward, around the fringes of the crowd. Out on the field, plump Lord Alan Cockshaw was limping off between two squires, the latest conquest of young Glendon Ball. A third squire held his helm, its three proud feathers broken.
"Sir John the Fiddler," the herald cried. "Sir Franklin of House Frey, a knight of the Twins, sworn to the Lord of the Crossing. Come forth and prove your valor."
Dunk could only stand and watch as the fiddler's big black trotted onto the field in a swirl of blue silk and golden swords and fiddles. His breastplate was enameled blue as well, as were his polines, cooter, greaves, and gorget. The ringmail underneath was gilded. Sir Franklin rode a dapple gray with a flowing silver mane to match the gray of his silks and the silver of his armor. On shield and surcoat and horse trappings, he bore the twin towers of Frey. They charged and charged again. Dunk stood watching but saw none of it. Dunk the Lunk, thick as a castle wall, he chided himself. He had a snail upon his shield. How could you lose to a man with a snail upon his shield? There was cheering all around him. When Dunk looked up, he saw that Franklin Frey was down. The fiddler had dismounted to help his fallen foe back to his feet. He is one step closer to his dragon's egg, Dunk thought. And where am I? As he approached the postern gate, Dunk came upon the company of dwarfs from last night's feast preparing to take their leave. They were hitching ponies to their wheeled wooden pig, and a second wain of more conventional design. There were six of them, he saw, each smaller and more malformed than the last. A few might have been children, but they were all so short that it was hard to tell. In daylight, dressed in horsehide breeches and rough-spun hooded cloaks, they seemed less jolly than they had in Motley.
"Good morrow to you," Dunk said to be courteous. "Are you for the road? There's clouds to the east. Could mean rain."
The only answer that he got was a glare from the ugliest dwarf. Was he the one I pulled off Lady Butterwell last night? Up close, the little man smelled like a privy. One whiff was enough to make Dunk hasten his steps. The walk across the milk house seemed to take Dunk as long as it had once taken him and Egg to cross the sands of Dorne. He kept a wall beside him, and from time to time he leaned on it. Every time he turned his head, the world would swim. A drink, he thought. I need a drink of water, or else I'm like to fall. A passing groom told him where to find the nearest well. It was there that he discovered Kyle the Cat talking quietly with Maynard Plum. Sir Kyle's shoulders were slumped in dejection, but he looked up at Dunk's approach.
Sir Duncan, we heard that you were dead or dying.
Dunk rubbed his temples. I only wish I were.
I know the feeling well.
Sir Kyle sighed. Lord Caswell did not know me. When I told him how I carved his first sword, he stared at me as if I'd lost my wits. He said there was no place at Bitterbridge for knights as feeble as I had shown myself to be. The cat gave a bitter laugh. He took my arms and armor, though, my mount as well. What will I do? Dunk had no answer for him. Even a free rider required a horse to ride. Sell swords must have swords to sell.
You will find another horse, Dunk said as he drew the bucket up. The Seven Kingdoms are full of horses. You will find some other lord to arm you.
He cupped his hands, filled them with water, drank.
Some other lord, aye. Do you know of one? I am not so young and strong as you, nor so big. Big men are always in demand. Lord Butterwell likes his knights large for one. Look at that Tom Heddle. Have you seen him joust? He has overthrown every man he's faced. Fireball's lad has done the same, though. The Fiddler as well. Would that he had been the one to unhorse me. He refuses to take ransoms. He wants no more than the dragon's egg, he says. That and the friendship of his fallen foes. The flower of chivalry, that one.
Maynard Plum gave a laugh.
The fiddle of chivalry, you mean? That boy is fiddling up a storm, and all of us would do well to be gone from here before it breaks.
He takes no ransoms, said Dunk. A gallant gesture.
Gallant gestures come easy when your purse is fat with gold, said Sir Maynard. There is a lesson here, if you have the sense to take it, Sir Duncan. It is not too late for you to go.
Go? Go where? Sir Maynard shrugged.
Anywhere. Winterfell, Summerhall, Ashai by the Shadow. It makes no matter so long as it's not here. Take your horse and armor and slip out the postern gate. You won't be missed. The snail's got his next tilt to think about, and the rest have eyes only for the jousting.
For half a heartbeat, Dunk was tempted. So long as he was armed and horsed, he would remain a knight of sorts. Without them, he was no more than a beggar. A big beggar, but a beggar all the same. But his arms and armor belonged to Ser Uthor now. So did Thunder. Better a beggar than a thief. He had been both in Flea Bottom when he ran with Ferret, Rafe, and Pudding, but the old man had saved him from that life. He knew what Ser Arlen of Pennytree would have said to Plum's suggestions. Ser Arlen being dead, Dunk said it for him. Even a hedge knight has his honor.
Would you rather die with honor intact or live with it besmirched? No, spare me, I know what you will say. Take your boy and flee, gallows knight, before your arms become your destiny.
Dunk bristled. How would you know my destiny? Did you have a dream, like John the Fiddler? What do you know of Egg?
I know that eggs do well to stay out of frying pans, said Plum. White Walls is not a healthy place for the boy.
How did you fare in your own tilt, sir? Dunk asked him.
Oh, I did not chance the lists. The omens had gone sour. Who do you imagine is going to claim the dragon's egg, pray?
Not me, Dunk thought. The Seven know, I don't.
Venture a guess, sir. You have two eyes.
He thought a moment. The Fiddler?
Very good. Would you care to explain your reasoning?
I have a feeling.
So do I, said Maynard Plum. A bad feeling for any man or boy unwise enough to stand in our fiddler's way.
Egg was brushing Thunder's coat outside their tent, but his eyes were far away. The boy has taken my fall hard.
Enough, Dunk called. Any more and Thunder will be as bald as you.
Sir?
Egg dropped the brush. I knew no stupid snail could kill you, sir. He threw his arms around him. Dunk swiped the boy's floppy straw hat and put it on his own head.
The maester said you made off with my armor.
Egg snatched back his hat indignantly.
I've scoured your mail and polished your greaves, gorget, and breastplate, sir, but your helm is cracked and dinted where Sir Uther's coronal struck. You'll need to have it hammered out by an armorer.
Let Sir Uther have it hammered out. It's his now.
No horse, no sword, no armor.
Perhaps those dwarfs would let me join their troop. That would be a funny sight. 6 dwarfs pummeling a giant with pig bladders.
Thunder is his, too. Come. We'll take them to him and wish him well in the rest of his tilts.
Now, sir? Aren't you going to ransom Thunder?
With what, lad? Pebbles and sheep pellets?
I thought about that, sir. If you could borrow...
Dunk cut him off.
No one will lend me that much coin, Egg.
Why should they?
What am I but some great oaf who called himself a knight until some snail with a stick near stove his head in?
Well, said Egg, you could have rain, sir. I'll go back to riding maester. We'll go to Summer Hall. You can take service in my father's household. His stables are full of horses. You could have a destrier and a palfrey, too.
Egg meant well, but Dunk could not go cringing back to Summer Hall. Not that way, penniless and beaten, seeking service without so much as a sword to offer.
Lad, he said, that's good of you.
But I want no crumbs from your lord father's table, or from his stables, neither.
Might be it's time we parted ways.
Dunk could always slink off to join the city watch in Lannisport or Old Town. They liked big men for that.
I've bumped my bean on every beam in every inn from Lannisport to King's Landing. Might be it's time my size earned me a bit of coin instead of just a lumpy head.
But watchmen did not have squires.
I've taught you what I could, and that was little enough. You'll do better with a proper master at arms to see to your training, some fierce old knight who knows which end of the lance to hold.
I don't want a proper master at arms. Egg said, I want you. What if I used my...
No, none of that. I will not hear it. Go gather up my arms. We will present them to Sir Uther with my compliments. Hard things only grow harder if you put them off.
Egg kicked the ground, his face as droopy as his big straw hat.
Aye, sir, as you say.
Not until the walls and towers of Coldmoat had vanished in the west behind them did Dunk turn to Egg and say, "What words were written on that paper?" "It was a grant of right, sir, to Lord Wyman Webber from the king. For his leal service in the late rebellion, Lord Wyman and his descendants were granted all rights to the Checky Water from where it rises in the Horseshoe Hills to the shores of Leafy Lake. It also said that Lord Wyman and his descendants should have the right to take red deer and boar and rabbits in Watts Wood whene'er it pleased them, and to cut 20 trees from the wood each year." The boy cleared his throat. "The grant was only for a time, though. The paper said that if Sir Eustace were to die without a male heir of his body, Standfast would revert to the crown, and Lord Webber's privileges would end. They were the marshals of the North March for 1,000 years. All they left the old man was a tower to die in." "And his head," said Egg. "His grace did leave him his head, sir, even though he was a rebel." Dunk gave the boy a look. "Would you have taken it?" Egg had to think about it. "Sometimes at court I would serve the king's small council. They used to fight about it. Uncle Baylor said that clemency was best when dealing with an honorable foe. If a defeated man believes he will be pardoned, he may lay down his sword and bend the knee. Elsewise he will fight on to the death, and slay more loyal men and innocents. But Lord Bloodraven said that when you pardon rebels, you only plant the seeds of the next rebellion." His voice was full of doubts. "Why would Sir Eustace rise against King Darren? He was a good king, everybody says so. He brought Dawn into the realm and made the Dornishmen our friends." "You would have to ask Sir Eustace, Egg." Dunk thought he knew the answer, but it was not one the boy would want to hear. He wanted a castle with a lion on the gatehouse, but all he got were graves among the blackberries. When you swore a man your sword, you promised to serve and obey, to fight for him at need, not to pry into his affairs and question his allegiances. But Sir Eustace had played him for a fool. He said his sons died fighting for the king, and let me believe the stream was his. Night caught them in Watts Wood. That was Dunk's fault. He should have gone the straight way home, the way they'd gone, but instead he'd taken them north for another look at the dam. He had half a thought to try and tear the thing apart with his bare hands, but the Severn and Sir Lucas Longinch did not prove so obliging. When they reached the dam, they found it guarded by a pair of crossbowmen with spider badges sewn on their jerkins. One sat with his bare feet in the stolen water. Dunk could gladly have throttled him for that alone, but the man heard them coming and was quick to snatch up his bow. His fellow, even quicker, had a quarrel knocked and ready. The best that Dunk could do was scowl at them threateningly. After that, there was naught to do but retrace their steps. Dunk did not know these lands as well as Sir Bennis did. It would have been humiliating to get lost in a wood as small as Watts. By the time they splashed across the stream, the sun was low on the horizon and the first stars were coming out, along with clouds of mites. Amongst the tall black trees, Egg found his tongue again. "Sir, that fat Septon said my father sulks in Summerhall. Words are wind. My father doesn't sulk." "Well," said Dunk, "he might. You sulk."
"I do not."
"Sir?" He frowned.
"Do I?"
"Some. Not too often, though. Elsewise I'd clout you in the ear more than I do."
"You clouted me in the ear at the gate?"
"That was half a clout at best. If I ever give you a whole clout, you'll know it." "The Red Widow give you a whole clout?" Dunk touched his swollen lip. "You don't need to sound so pleased about it. No one ever clouted your father in the ear, though. Maybe that's why Prince Makar is the way he is. When the king named Lord Bloodraven his hand, your lord father refused to be part of his council and departed King's Landing for his own seat," he reminded Egg. "He has been at Summerhall for a year and half of another. What do you call that, if not sulking?" "I call it being wroth," Egg declared loftily. "His grace should have made my father hand. He's his brother, and the finest battle commander in the realm since Uncle Baylor died. Lord Bloodraven's not even a real lord. That's just some stupid courtesy. He's a sorcerer, and base-born besides."
"Bastard-born, not base-born."
"Bloodraven might not be a real lord, but he was noble on both sides. His mother had been one of the many mistresses of King Aegon the Unworthy. Aegon's bastards had been the bane of the Seven Kingdoms ever since the old king died. He had legitimized the lot upon his deathbed. Not only the great bastards like Bloodraven, Bittersteel, and Daemon Blackfyre, whose mothers had been ladies, but even the lesser ones he'd fathered on whores and tavern wenches, merchants' daughters, mummers' maidens, and every pretty peasant girl who chanced to catch his eye. Fire and blood were the words of House Targaryen, but Dunk once heard Sir Arlen say that Aegon's should have been washer and bringer to my bed. King Aegon washed Bloodraven clean of bastardy," he reminded Egg, "the same as he did the rest of them. The old High Septon told my father that king's laws are one thing and the laws of the gods another," the boy said stubbornly. "True-born children are made in a marriage bed and blessed by the father and the mother, but bastards are born of lust and weakness," he said. "King Aegon decreed that his bastards were not bastards, but he could not change their nature. The High Septon said all bastards are born to betrayal. Daemon Blackfyre, Bittersteel, even Bloodraven. Lord Rivers was more cunning than the other two, he said, but in the end he would prove himself a traitor too. The High Septon counselled my father never to put any trust in him, nor in any other bastards, great or small." "Born to betrayal," Dunk thought. "Born of lust and weakness. Never to be trusted, great or small." "Egg," he said, "didn't you ever think that I might be a bastard?"
"You, sir?"
That took the boy aback.
"You are not." "I might be. I never knew my mother or what became of her. Maybe I was born too big and killed her. Most like she was some whore or tavern girl. You don't find high-born ladies down in Flea Bottom. And if she ever wed my father, well, what became of him then?"
Dunk did not like to be reminded of his life before Sir Arlen found him.
"There was a pot shop in King's Landing where I used to sell them rats and cats and pigeons for the brown. The cook always claimed my father was some thief or cutpurse. Most like I saw him hanged, he used to tell me, but maybe they just sent him to the wall. When I was squiring for Sir Arlen, I would ask him if we couldn't go up that way some day, to take service at Winterfell or some other northern castle. I had this notion that if I could only reach the wall, might be I'd come on some old man, a real tall man who looked like me. We never went, though. Sir Arlen said there were no hedges in the north and all the woods were full of wolves. He shook his head. The long and short of it is, most like, you're squiring for a bastard. For once, Egg had nothing to say. The gloom was deepening around them. Lantern bugs moved slowly through the trees, their little lights like so many drifting stars. There were stars in the sky as well, more stars than any man could ever hope to count, even if he lived to be as old as King Jaehaerys. Dunk need only lift his eyes to find familiar friends. The stallion and the sow, the king's crown and the crone's lantern, the galley, ghost and moon maid. But there were clouds to the north, and the blue eye of the ice dragon was lost to him, the blue eye that pointed north. The moon had risen by the time they came to Standfast, standing dark and tall atop its hill. A pale yellow light was spilling from the tower's upper windows, he saw. Most nights, Sir Eustace sought his bed as soon as he had supped, but not tonight, it seemed. He is waiting for us, Dunk knew. Bennis of the Brown Shield was waiting up as well. They found him sitting on the tower steps, chewing sour leaf and honing his long sword in the moonlight. The slow scrape of stone on steel carried a long way. However much Sir Bennis might neglect his clothes and person, he kept his weapons well. "The lunk comes back," Bennis said. "Here I was sharpening my steel to go rescue you from that Red Widow." "Where are the men?" "Treb and Wetwater on the roof, standing watch in case the widow comes to call. The rest crawled into bed, whimpering. Sore as sin they are. I worked them hard. Drew a little blood off that big lackwit just to make him mad. He fights better when he's mad." He smiled his brown and red smile. "Nice bloody lip you got. Next time don't go turning over rocks. What did the woman say?"
"She means to keep the water, and she wants you as well for cutting that digger by the dam."
"Thought she might," Bennis spat. "Lot of bother for some peasant. He ought to thank me. Women like a man with scars."
"You won't mind her slitting your nose, then?"
"Bugger that. If I wanted my nose slit, I'd slit it for myself."
He jerked a thumb up.
"You'll find Sir Useless in his chambers, brooding on how great he used to be."
Egg spoke up. "He fought for the Black Dragon." Dunk could have given the boy a clout, but the Brown Knight only laughed.
"Course he did. Just look at him. He strike you as the kind who picks the winning side?"
"No more than you, else you wouldn't be here with us." Dunk turned to Egg. "Tend to Thunder and Maester, and then come up and join us."
When Dunk came up through the trap, the old knight was sitting by the hearth in his bedrobe, though no fire had been laid. His father's cup was in his hand, a heavy silver cup that had been made for some Lord Osgray back before the Conquest. A checky lion adorned the bowl, done in flakes of jade and gold, though some of the jade flakes had gone missing. At the sound of Dunk's footsteps, the old knight looked up and blinked like a man waking from a dream.
"Sir Duncan, you are back. Did the sight of you give Lucas Inchfield pause, sir?"
"Not as I saw, my lord. More like it made him wroth."
Dunk told it all as best he could, though he omitted the part about Lady Helicent, which made him look an utter fool. He would have left out the clout, too, but his broken lip had puffed up twice its normal size, and Sir Eustace could not help but notice. When he did, he frowned.
"Your lip," Dunk touched it gingerly. "Her ladyship gave me a slap."
"She struck you?"
His mouth opened and closed.
"She struck my envoy, who came to her beneath the checky lion? She dared lay hands upon your person?"
"Only the one hand, sir. It stopped bleeding before we even left the castle." He made a fist. "She wants Sir Bennis, not your silver, and she won't take down the dam. She showed me a parchment with some writing on it, and the king's own seal. It said the stream is hers, and—" He hesitated. "She said that you were— that you had risen with the Black Dragon." Sir Eustace seemed to slump. "I feared she might. If you wish to leave my service, I will not stop you."
The old knight gazed into his cup, though what he might be looking for, Dunk could not say.
"You told me your sons died fighting for the king."
"And so they did. The rightful king, Daemon Blackfyre. The king who bore the sword."
The old man's moustache quivered.
The men of the Red Dragon call themselves the Loyalists, but we who chose the Black were just as loyal once. Though now, all the men who marched beside me to seat Prince Daemon on the Iron Throne have melted away like morning dew. Mayhaps I dreamed them, or more like Lord Bloodraven and his raven's teeth have put the fear in them. They cannot all be dead. Dunk could not deny the truth of that. Until this moment he had never met a man who'd fought for the Pretender. I must have, though. There were thousands of them. Half the realm was for the Red Dragon, and half was for the Black. Both sides fought valiantly, Sir Arlan always said. He thought the old knight would want to hear that. Sir Eustace cradled his wine cup in both hands. If Daemon had ridden over Gawain Corbury, if Fireball had not been slain on the eve of battle, if Hightower and Tarbeck and Oakheart and Butterwell had lent us their full strength instead of trying to keep one foot in each camp, if Manfred Loston had proved true instead of treacherous, if storms had not delayed Lord Bracken's sailing with the Myrish crossbowmen, if Quickfinger had not been caught with the stolen dragon's eggs. So many ifs, sir. Had anyone come out differently, it could all have turned t'other way. Then we would be called the Loyalists, and the Red Dragons would be remembered as men who fought to keep the usurper Daeron the Falseborn upon his stolen throne, and failed. That's as it may be, my lord, said Dunk. But things went the way they went. It was all years ago, and you were pardoned. Aye, we were pardoned. So long as we bent the knee and gave him a hostage to ensure our future loyalty, Daeron forgave the traitors and the rebels. His voice was bitter. I bought my head back with my daughter's life. Alison was 7 when they took her off to King's Landing, and 20 when she died. A silent sister. I went to King's Landing once to see her, and she would not even speak to me, her own father. A king's mercy is a poisoned gift. Daeron Targaryen left me life, but took my pride and dreams and honour. His hand trembled, and wine spilled red upon his lap, but the old man took no notice of it. I should have gone with bitter steel into exile, or died beside my sons and my sweet king. That would have been a death worthy of a Cheki lion, descended from so many proud lords and mighty warriors. Daeron's mercy made me smaller. In his heart, the Black Dragon never died, Dunk realized. My lord? It was Egg's voice. The boy had come in as Sir Eustace was speaking of his death. The old knight blinked at him as if he were seeing him for the first time. Yes, lad. What is it? If it please you, the Red Widow says you rebelled to get her castle. That isn't true, is it? The castle? He seemed confused. Coldmoat. Coldmoat was promised me by Daemon, yes, but it was not for gain, no. Then why? Asked Egg. Why? Sir Eustace frowned. Why you were a traitor, if it wasn't just the castle. Sir Eustace looked at Egg a long time before replying, You are only a young boy. You would not understand. Well, said Egg, I might. Treason is only a word. When two princes fight for a chair where only one may sit, great lords and common men alike must choose. And when the battle's done, the victors will be hailed as loyal men and true, whilst those who were defeated will be known forevermore as rebels and traitors. That was my fate. Egg thought about it for a time. Yes, my lord. Only King Daeron was a good man. Why would you choose Daemon? Daeron. Sir Eustace almost slurred the word, and Dunk realized he was half drunk. Daeron was spindly and round of shoulder with a little belly that wobbled when he walked. Daemon stood straight and proud, and his stomach was flat and hard as an oaken shield. And he could fight. With axe or lance or flail, he was as good as any knight I ever saw. But with the sword, he was the warrior himself. When Prince Daemon had black fire in his hand, there was not a man to equal him. Not Ulric Dane with Dawn, no, nor even the Dragon Knight with Dark Sister. You can know a man by his friends, Egg. Daeron surrounded himself with maesters, septons, and singers. Always there were women whispering in his ear, and his court was full of Dornishmen. How not, when he had taken a Dornish woman into his bed and sold his own sweet sister to the Prince of Dawn, though it was Daemon that she loved?
Darren bore the same name as the young dragon, but when his Dornish wife gave him a son, he named the child Balor, after the feeblest king who ever sat the Iron Throne. Daemon, though. Daemon was no more pious than a king need be, and all the great knights of the realm gathered to him. It would suit Lord Bloodraven if their names were all forgotten, so he has forbidden us to sing of them, but I remember. Rob Rain, Gareth the Grey, Sir Aubrey Ambrose, Lord Gorman Peak, Black Byron Flowers, Red Tusk Fireball, Bitter Steel. I ask you, has there ever been such a noble company, such a roll of heroes? Why, lad? You ask me why. Because Daemon was the better man. The old king saw it too. He gave the sword to Daemon, Blackfyre, the sword of Aegon the Conqueror, the blade that every Targaryen king had wielded since the conquest. He put that sword in Daemon's hand the day he knighted him, a boy of 12. My father says that was because Daemon was a swordsman, and Darren never was, said Egg. Why give a horse to a man who cannot ride? The sword was not the kingdom, he says. The old knight's hand jerked so hard that wine spilled from his silver cup. Your father is a fool. He is not, the boy said. Osgrave's face twisted in anger. You asked a question, and I answered it, but I will not suffer insolence. Sir Duncan, you should beat this boy more often. His courtesy leaves much to be desired. If I must needs do it myself, I will. No, Dunk broke in. You won't, sir. He had made up his mind. It is dark. We will leave at first light. Sir Eustace stared at him, stricken. Leave? Stand fast. Your service. You lied to us. Call it what you will. There was no honor in it. He unfastened his cloak, rolled it up, and put it in the old man's lap. Osgrey's eyes grew narrow. Did that woman offer to take you into service? Are you leaving me for that whore's bed? I don't know that she is a whore, Dunk said. Or a witch, or a poisoner, or none of that. But whatever she may be makes no matter. We're leaving for the hedges, not for Coldmoat. The ditches, you mean? You're leaving me to prowl in the woods like wolves, to waylay honest men upon the roads. His hand was shaking. The cup fell from his fingers, spilling wine as it rolled along the floor. Go, then. Go, I want none of you. I should never have taken you on. Go. As you say, sir. Dunk beckoned, and Egg followed. That last night, Dunk wanted to be as far from Eustace Osgrey as he could, so they slept down in the cellar, amongst the rest of Standfast's meagre host. It was a restless night. Lem and red-eyed Pate both snored, the one loudly and the other constantly. Dank vapours filled the cellar, rising through the trap from the deeper vaults below. Dunk tossed and turned on the scratchy bed, drifting off into a half-sleep, only to wake suddenly in darkness. The bites he'd gotten in the woods were itching fiercely, and there were fleas in the straw as well. I will be well rid of this place, well rid of the old man, and Sir Bennis and the rest of them. Maybe it was time that he took Egg back to Summerhall to see his father. He would ask the boy about that in the morning when they were well away. Morning seemed a long way off, though. Dunk's head was full of dragons, red and black, full of checky lions, old shields, battered boots, full of streams and moats and dams, and papers stamped with the king's great seal that he could not read. And she was there as well, the Red Widow, Rohan of the Cold Moat. He could see her freckled face, her slender arms, her long red braid. It made him feel guilty. I should be dreaming of Tansel. Tansel Too Tall, they called her, but she was not too tall for me. She had painted arms upon his shield, and he had saved her from the Bright Prince, but she vanished even before the Trial of Seven. She could not bear to see me die, Dunk often told himself, but what did he know? He was as thick as a castle wall. Just thinking of the Red Widow was proof enough of that. Tansel smiled at me, but we never held each other, never kissed, not even lips to cheek. Rohan, at least, had touched him. He had the swollen lip to prove it. Don't be daft. She's not for the likes of you. She's too small, too clever, and much too dangerous. Drowsing at long last, Dunk dreamed. He was running through a glade in the heart of Watts Wood, running toward Rohan, and she was shooting arrows at him. Each shaft she loosed flew true and pierced him through the chest, yet the pain was strangely sweet. He should have turned and fled, but he ran toward her instead, running slowly, as you always did in dreams, as if the very air had turned to honey. Another arrow came, and yet another. Her quiver seemed to have no end of shafts. Her eyes were grey and green and full of mischief. "Your gown brings out the colour of your eyes," he meant to say to her, but she was not wearing any gown or any clothes at all. Across her small breasts was a faint spray of freckles, and her nipples were red and hard as little berries. The arrows made him look like some great porcupine as he went stumbling to her feet, but somehow he still found the strength to grab her braid. With one hard yank, he pulled her down on top of him and kissed her. He woke suddenly at the sound of a shout. In the darkened cellar, all was confusion. Curses and complaints echoed back and forth, and men were stumbling over one another as they fumbled for their spears or breeches. No one knew what was happening. Egg found the tallow candle and got it lit to shed some light upon the scene. Dunk was the first one up the steps. He almost collided with Sam Stoops rushing down, puffing like a bellows and babbling incoherently. Dunk had to hold him by both shoulders to keep him from falling. "Sam? What's wrong?" "The sky," the old man whimpered. "The sky!" No more sense could be gotten from him, so they all went up to the roof for a look. Sir Eustace was there before them, standing by the parapets in his bedrobe, staring off into the distance. The sun was rising in the west. It was a long moment before Dunk realized what that meant. "Watts Wood is afire," he said in a hushed voice. From down at the base of the tower came the sound of Bennis cursing, a stream of such surpassing filth that it might have made Aegon the Unworthy blush. Sam Stoops began to pray. They were too far away to make out flames, but the red glow engulfed half the western horizon, and above the light the stars were vanishing. The king's crown was half gone already, obscured behind a veil of the rising smoke. "Fire and sword," she said. The fire burned until morning. No one in Standfast slept that night. Before long they could smell the smoke and see flames dancing in the distance like girls in scarlet skirts. They all wondered if the fire would engulf them. Dunk stood behind the parapets, his eyes burning, watching for riders in the night. "Bennis," he said, when the brown knight came up, chewing on his sour leaf. "It's you she wants. Might be you should go." "What, run?" he brayed. "On my horse? Might as well try to fly off on one of these damned chickens." "Then give yourself up. She'll only slit your nose." "I like my nose how it is, Lunk. Let her try and take me. We'll see what gets slit open." He sat cross-legged with his back against a merlin and took a whetstone from his pouch to sharpen his sword. Sir Eustace stood above him. In low voices they spoke of how to fight the war. "The Long Inch will expect us at the dam," Dunk heard the old knight say, "so we will burn her crops instead. Fire for fire." Sir Bennis thought that would be just the thing, only maybe they should put her mill to the torch as well. "It's 6 leagues on t'other side of the castle. The Long Inch won't be looking for us there. Burn the mill and kill the miller. That'll cost her dear." Egg was listening too. He coughed and looked at Dunk with wide white eyes.
"Sir, you have to stop them."
"How?" Dunk asked. "The Red Widow will stop them. Her and that Lucas the Long Inch. They're only making noise, Egg. It's that or piss their britches. And it's naught to do with us now."
Arya. Arya's stitches were crooked again. She frowned down on them with dismay and glanced over to where her sister Sansa sat among the other girls. Sansa's needlework was exquisite. Everyone said so. "Sansa's work is as pretty as she is," Septa Mordaine told their lady mother once. "She has such fine, delicate hands." When Lady Catelyn had asked about Arya, the Septa sniffed. "Arya has the hands of a blacksmith." Arya glanced furtively across the room, worried the Septa Mordaine might have read her thoughts, but the Septa was paying her no attention today. She was sitting with the Princess Marcella, all smiles and admiration. It was not often that the Septa was privileged to instruct a royal princess in the womanly arts, as she had said when the Queen brought Marcella to join them. Arya thought Marcella's stitches looked a little crooked too, but you would never know it from the way Septa Mordaine was cooing. She studied her own work again, looking for some way to salvage it, then sighed and put down the needle. She looked glumly at her sister. Sansa was chatting away happily as she worked. Beth Cassell, Sir Roderick's little girl, was sitting by her feet, listening to every word she said, and Jane Poole was leaning over to whisper something in her ear. "What are you talking about?" Arya asked suddenly. Jane gave a startled look, then giggled. Sansa looked abashed. Beth blushed. No one answered. "Tell me," Arya said. Jane glanced over to make certain that Septa Mordane was not listening. Marcella said something then, and the Septa laughed along with the rest of the ladies. "We were talking about the prince," Sansa said, her voice soft as a kiss. Arya knew which prince she meant. Joffrey, of course. The tall, handsome one. Sansa got to sit with him at the feast. Arya had to sit with the little, fat one, naturally. "Joffrey likes your sister," Jane whispered, proud as if she had something to do with it. She was the daughter of Winterfell Stewart and Sansa's dearest friend. He told her she was very beautiful. "He's going to marry her," little Beth said dreamily, hugging herself. "Then Sansa will be queen of all the realm." Sansa had the grace to blush. She blushed prettily. She did everything prettily, Arya thought with dull resentment. "Beth, you shouldn't make up stories," Sansa corrected the younger girl, gently stroking her hair to take the harshness out of her words. She looked at Arya. "What do you think of Prince Joff's sister?" "He's very gallant, don't you think?" "John says he looks like a girl," Arya said. Sansa sighed as she stitched. "Oh, poor John," she said. "He gets jealous because he's a bastard." "He's our brother," Arya said, much too loudly. Her voice cut through the afternoon quiet of the tower room. Septa Mordane raised her eyes. She had a bony face, sharp eyes, and a thin, lipless mouth made for frowning. It was frowning now. "What are you talking about, children?" "Our half-brother," Sansa corrected, soft and precise. She smiled for the Septa. "Arya and I were remarking on how pleased we were to have the princess with us today," she said. Septa Mordane nodded. "Indeed, a great honour for us all." Princess Marcella smiled uncertainly at the compliment. "Arya, why aren't you at work?" the Septa asked. She rose to her feet, starched skirts rustling as she started across the room. "Let me see your stitches." Arya wanted to scream. It was just like Sansa to go and attract the Septa's attention. "Here," she said, surrendering her work. The Septa examined the fabric. "Arya, Arya, Arya," she said. "This will not do. This will not do at all." Everyone was looking at her. It was too much. Sansa was too well-bred to smile at her sister's disgrace, but Jane was smirking on her behalf. Even Princess Marcella looked sorry for her. Arya felt tears filling her eyes. She pushed herself out of her chair and bolted for the door. Septa Mordane called after her. "Arya, come back here. Don't you take another step. Your lady mother will hear of this in front of our royal princess, too. You'll shame us all." Arya stopped at the door and turned back, biting her lip. The tears were running down her cheeks now. She managed a stiff little bow to Marcella. "By your leave, my lady." Marcella blinked at her and looked to her ladies for guidance. But if she was uncertain, Septa Mordane was not. "Just where do you think you're going, Arya?" the Septa demanded. Arya glared at her. "I have to go and shoe a horse," she said sweetly, taking a brief satisfaction in the shock on the Septa's face. Then she whirled and made her exit, running down the steps as fast as her feet would take her. It wasn't fair. Sansa had everything. Sansa was 2 years older. Maybe by the time Arya had been born, there had been nothing left. Often it felt that way. Sansa could sew and dance and sing. She wrote poetry. She knew how to dress. She played the high harp and the bells. Worse, she was beautiful. Sansa had gotten their mother's fine high cheekbones and the thick auburn hair of the Tullys. Arya took after their lord father. Her hair was a lusterless brown, and her face was long and solemn. Jane used to call her Arya Horseface and neigh when she came near. It hurt that the one thing Arya could do better than her sister was ride a horse. Well, that, and manage a household. Sansa had never had much of a head for figures. If she did marry Prince Joff, Arya hoped for his sake that he had a good steward. Nymeria was waiting for her in the guardroom at the bottom of the stairs. She bounded to her feet as soon as she caught sight of Arya. Arya grinned. The wolf pup loved her, even if no one else did. They went everywhere together, and Nymeria slept in her room at the foot of her bed. If Mother had not forbidden it, Arya would gladly have taken the wolf with her to needlework. Let Septa Mordain complain about her stitches then. Nymeria nipped eagerly at her hand as Arya untied her. She had yellow eyes. When they caught the sunlight, they gleamed like two golden coins. Arya had named her after the warrior queen of the Roine, who had led her people across the narrow sea. That had been a great scandal, too. Sansa, of course, had named her pup Lady. Arya made a face and hugged the wolfling tight. Nymeria licked her ear, and she giggled. By now, Septa Mordain would certainly have sent word to her lady mother. If she went to her room, they would find her. Arya did not care to be found. She had a better notion. The boys were at practice in the yard. She wanted to see Rob put gallant Prince Joffrey flat on his back. "Come," she whispered to Nymeria. She got up and ran, the wolf coming hard at her heels. There was a window in the covered bridge between the armory and the great keep, where you had a view of the whole yard. That was where they headed. They arrived, flushed and breathless, to find John seated on the sill, one leg drawn up languidly to his chin. He was watching the action so absorbed that he seemed unaware of her approach until his white wolf moved to meet them. Nymeria stalked closer on wary feet. Ghost, already larger than his litter mates, smelled her, gave her ear a careful nip, and settled back down. John gave her a curious look. "Shouldn't you be working on your stitches, little sister?" Arya made a face at him. "I wanted to see them fight." He smiled. "Come here, then." Arya climbed up on the window and sat beside him, to a chorus of thuds and grunts from the yard below. To a disappointment, it was the younger boys drilling. Bran was so heavily padded, he looked as though he had belted on a feather bed. And Prince Tommen, who was plump to begin with, seemed positively round. They were huffing and puffing and hitting each other with padded wooden swords under the watchful eye of old Sir Roderick Cassell, the master-at-arms, a great stout keg of a man with magnificent white cheek whiskers. A dozen spectators, man and boy, were calling out encouragement, Rob's voice the loudest among them. She spotted Theon Greyjoy beside him, his black doublet emblazoned with the golden kraken of his house, a look of wry contempt on his face. Both of the combatants were staggering. Arya judged that they had been at it a while. "A shade more exhausting than needlework," John observed. "A shade more fun than needlework," Arya gave back at him. John grinned, reached over, and messed up her hair. Arya flushed. They had always been close. John had his father's face, as she did. They were the only ones. Rob and Sansa and Bran, and even little Rickon, all took after the Tullys, with easy smiles and fire in their hair. When Arya had been little, she had been afraid that meant that she was a bastard too. It had been John she had gone to in her fear, and John who had reassured her. "Why aren't you down in the yard?" Arya asked him. He gave her a half smile. "Bastards are not allowed to damage young princes," he said. "Any bruises they take in the practice yard must come from true-born swords." "Oh." Arya felt abashed. She should have realized. For the second time today, Arya reflected that life was not fair. She watched her little brother whack at Tommen. "I could do just as good as Bran," she said. "He's only 7, I'm 9. John looked her over with all his 14-year-old wisdom. "You're too skinny," he said. He took her arm to feel her muscle. Then he sighed and shook his head. "I doubt you could even lift a longsword, little sister, never mind swing one." Ariel snatched back her arm and glared at him. John messed up her hair again. They watched Bran and Tommen circle each other. "You see Prince Joffrey?" John asked. She hadn't, not at first glance, but when she looked again, she found him to the back, under the shade of a high stone wall. He was surrounded by men she did not recognize, young squires in the livery of Lannister and Baratheon, strangers all. There were a few older men among them, knights, she surmised. "Look at the arms on his surcoat," John suggested. Arya looked. An ornate shield had been embroidered on the prince's padded surcoat. No doubt the needlework was exquisite. The arms were divided down the middle. On one side was a crown stag of the royal house, on the other the Lion of Lannister. "The Lannisters are proud," John observed. "You think the royal sigil would be sufficient, but no. He makes his mother's house equal in honour to the king's." "The woman is important too," Arya protested. John chuckled. "Perhaps you should do the same thing, little sister. Wed Tully to Stark in your arms."
"A wolf with a fish in its mouth," it made her laugh. "That would look silly. Besides, if a girl can't fight, why should she have a coat of arms?"
John shrugged. "Girls get the arms, but not the swords. Bastards get the swords, but not the arms. I did not make the rules, little sister." There was a shout from the courtyard below. Prince Tommen was rolling in the dust, trying to get up and failing. All the padding made him look like a turtle on its back. Bran was standing over him with upraised wooden sword, ready to whack him again once he regained his feet. The men began to laugh. "Enough!" Sir Roderick called out. He gave the prince a hand and yanked him to his feet. "Well fought! Loo! Donis! Help them out of their armour!" He looked around. "Prince Joffrey, Rob, will you go another round?" Rob, already sweaty from a previous bout, moved forward eagerly. "Gladly." Joffrey moved into the sunlight in response to Roderick's summons. His hair shone like spun gold. He looked bored. "This is a game for children, Sir Roderick." Theon Greyjoy gave a sudden bark of laughter. "You are children," he said derisively. "Rob may be a child," Joffrey said. "I am a prince, and I go tired of swatting at Starks with a play sword." "You got more swats than you gave, Joff," Rob said. "Are you afraid?" Prince Joffrey looked at him. "Oh, terrified," he said. "You're so much older." Some of the Lannister men laughed. John looked down on the scene with a frown. "Joffrey is truly a little shit," he told Arya. Sir Roderick tugged thoughtfully at his white whiskers. "What are you suggesting?" he asked the prince. "Live steel." "Done," Rob shot back. "You'll be sorry." The master at arms put a hand on Rob's shoulder to quiet him. "Live steel is too dangerous. I will permit you tawny swords with blunted edges." Joffrey said nothing. But a man strange to Arya, a tall knight with black hair and burnt scars on his face, pushed forward in front of the prince.
"This is your prince. Who are you to tell him he may not have an edge on his sword, sir?"
"Master-at-arms at Winterfell, Clegane, and you'll be well not to forget it. Are you training women here?" the burned man wanted to know. He was muscled like a bull. "I am training knights," Sir Roderick said pointedly. "They will have steel when they are ready, when they are of an age." The burned man looked at Rob. "How old are you, boy?"
14, Rob said.
"I killed a man at 12. You can be sure it was not with a blunt sword." Arya could see Rob bristle. His pride was wounded. He turned to Sir Roderick.
Let me do it. I can beat him."
"Beat him with a tawny blade, then," Sir Roderick said. Joffrey shrugged.
"Come and see me when you're older, Stark, if you're not too old." There was laughter from the Lannister men. Rob's curses rang through the yard. Arya covered her mouth in shock. Theon Greyjoy seized Rob's arm to keep him away from the prince. Sir Roderick tugged at his whiskers in dismay. Joffrey feigned a yawn and turned to his younger brother.
"Come, Tommen," he said. "The hour of play is done. Leave the children to their frolics."
That brought more laughter from the Lannisters, more curses from Rob. Sir Roderick's face was beet red with fury under the white of his whiskers. Theon kept Rob locked in an iron grip until the princes and their party were safely away. John watched them leave, and Arya watched John. His face had grown as still as the pool at the heart of the Godswood. Finally, he climbed down off the window. "The show's done," he said. He bent to scratch Ghost behind the